This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
One has to understand, if you look at a person who is obese, and you look at a person who is very trim and fit, I'm not talking about a person with a medical problem, a person who is just obese, and a person the same age, same medical condition, who is trim and fit, what do the two conditions say to you? At the end of the day, the one condition says to you, this is a person who knows how to say no, and this is a person who doesn't know how to say no. That's the difference in the condition. That's what it means. It's not just the difference in appearance. And again, I'm not talking about a person who, for psychological reasons or whatever reason, has an eating disorder. I'm talking about two people who are absolutely normal, living good, healthy lives, no problems. What differentiates the one from the other? And I'm not talking about one who believes there's nothing wrong. The one who's obese says, I really need to go on diet. I don't want to be this way. I want to look trim like my friend over here. But they don't. What is it? At the end of the day, it's that fitness is the consequence of a person being able to say no. It's the consequence of a person being able to dedicate time to his health, to go and work out, to go and do some physical exercise, to see some delicious food and say, no, it's not good for me. Don't want it. Delicious, but not for me. That's what it means. Now, those of us who can see souls, we've been talking about the last few weeks about the capacity to look at an neshama, to be able to see a neshama. You see obese souls, and you see trim souls, in exactly the same way. An obese soul is a soul that can't say no. And the soul is obese, and it operates slowly, and it's inefficient, and it doesn't enjoy, and it doesn't savor, and it doesn't look good, and it doesn't feel good in every way. It's an obese soul. There is such a thing as an obese soul. And therefore, just as physical fitness requires limitation, so spiritual fitness is going to require limitation. So when we talk about the fact that religion restricts, the answer is yes. Any ennoblement is going to restrict. Because at the end of the day, ennoblement is a process of making choices that are good for that which you're trying to ennoble. And rejecting things that are not good for the thing that you're trying to ennoble. So that there is going to be a certain area of life that you're not going to indulge in, that applies if you want to stay healthy physically, and that applies if you want to stay healthy spiritually. There's no difference. And why people can find fitness and health non-restrictive, but the laws of kashrut restrictive, are very difficult to understand, because kashrut allows a lot more indulgence than a good health regimen does. There's a lot more variety, and there's a lot more color, and there's a lot more taste, and there's a lot more creative possibility and potential in a kosher diet than in a strict health regimen diet. So some degree of restrictiveness there is. But when we talk of narrowness, I think that we have to differentiate between three different kinds of narrowness. The first type of narrowness is narrowness of experience. Dealing with somebody who has experienced very little of life. Kind of narrowness. A person who's grown up in a sheltered environment, lived a sheltered life, done the same things every day, every week, every month, every year, and never really experienced anything beyond that. That's one kind of narrowness. There's another kind of narrowness, which is narrow-mindedness. Narrow-mindedness is a person who is unable to engage intellectually in areas other than his narrow area of focus. So it's not just religious people who are narrow-minded, most specialists are narrow-minded. Unless they are specialists professionally, but broad-minded in their personal life. So they might be specialized in an area, but they're willing to engage even in areas that they have no knowledge. A narrow-minded person will not want to engage in an area where he has no knowledge. A broad-minded person will say, this is a learning opportunity. And I can use my knowledge in other areas to approach a new subject. And therefore he will engage. So we're talking about narrowness of experience is one kind of narrowness. Narrow-mindedness is another kind of narrowness. And the third one is narrowness of opinion. Where a person has a narrow area of opinion and will not engage or tolerate any deviation from his opinion. That's a narrow opinioned person is a different kind of narrowness altogether. And when we talk about the tendency of religious observance to bring with it narrowness, what do we mean? Do we mean we tend to experience that people becoming religious become narrower in their experiences? Yes, we do. Problem number one. Even though, what we're going to explore this evening is, even though there is a natural restrictiveness in becoming fit, whether it's fitness of the soul or fitness of the body, if you're on a fitness program, there is going to be restrictiveness. But that restrictiveness need not, we're going to argue tonight, need not bring with it even narrowness of experience. Narrowness of mind? Are we saying that as people become religious, they become more narrow-minded? Yes, we are. Problem. Shouldn't be so. Any other religion, that would be expected. Because other religions are based on dogma. But our religion is based on intellect. So why would our religion make people narrow-minded? People in our religion should be able to engage on a broader range of subjects than they could before they were religious. And our Gedol Yisrael, our great rabbinic lights, have always been able to do that. One of my favorite stories was the story of my father going off to our father was educated, his schooling was in South Africa, there wasn't much Torah in South Africa. And then he went to London and he studied with his uncle, Rabbi Melopian, whose great-granddaughter, is that right? Your great-granddaughter is with us from Manchester here as a guest this evening. There he went to study with his uncle, which was Rabbi Melopian, in London for several years, and Rabbi then sent him to Tells in Lithuania to study. And before he went, he said, the first opportunity you've got in the vacation time, you should go and visit Reb Daniel in Kelm. Because Reb Daniel is one of the greatest souls, one of the greatest minds, just one of the greatest tzaddikim that exists today. You need to see what greatness is. And you'll see greatness by experiencing Reb Daniel. And go to him and tell him I sent you. And my father spent 6 months preparing for that meeting. What are you going to talk to Reb Daniel about? So he spent six months preparing a piece of Gemara. So by the time the vacation came, he could discuss a piece of Gemara as an equal with Reb Daniel. So he comes to Reb Daniel. My father used to describe it, and what a shock it was to come to Reb Daniel, this great man, one of the greatest minds and human beings alive. And he lived in a hovel. And all he could offer him was a glass of water because he didn't have money even for a cup of tea. That was the poverty that Reb Daniel lived in. And he sits down, and there's this great man, and my father's ready to launch into this Talmudic discourse, and Reb Daniel says, what Shakespeare did you do in school? And my father says, well, the last year in school we did Macbeth. And he says, okay, let's discuss Macbeth. Well, how do you understand? What's it all about? My father is completely taken, tries to get his mind back into Macbeth. Reb Daniel destroys him, proves to him that everything he was taught was so superficial that they missed the essential themes of the play, how it interacts with the other Shakespeare plays. My father just couldn't figure out where he was, so he went back to Yeshiva and he studied King Lear like you can't imagine. And he read everything that's ever been written on King Lear. And 6 months later he comes back to Reb Daniel. And Reb Daniel says, what Gemara have you been learning? And he says, you know, last time I prepared Gemara, you asked me Shakespeare. This time I prepared Shakespeare, you're on to Gemara. What is it? He says, I want to engage with you in an area that you feel competent. When you've only been in Yeshiva for 6 months, I want to see how your mind works. By discussing Gemara, I'm not going to see how your mind works. I'll see how your mind works in Shakespeare. But now you've been in Yeshiva for a year already. Now we can talk Gemara and I can see how your mind works. But what's important is that Reb Daniel was absolutely familiar with Shakespeare in a way that the English professors aren't familiar with it. Because Torah shouldn't narrow. Torah should broaden. Speak to any professional that came out of a meeting with Rav Abramsky. And he died several years ago. The Lubavitcher Rebbe more recently. And many, many others. And the comment consistently was always, how does he know so much about my speciality? That's what Torah should do. Torah should give one the access to a wisdom that is so universal that it doesn't matter what you're discussing. So is Reb Daniel of Kelm narrow-minded? Just because he can't afford anything more than a glass of water? Not narrow-minded at all. Had my father come and said he was a nuclear physicist, he would have discussed nuclear physics with him. They wouldn't have made a difference what area it was. There was something that was written in one of the papers recently about a great Tani Kochum, a Rav in Bnei Brak, who gives medical advice to surgeons. And it's accurate, it's right, he understands. Has he ever studied medicine? No. And the Rambam, who is this great physician, is it because he studied medicine for so long? I'm sure he studied. But that wasn't where his medical wisdom came from. He used his Gemara mind with medical facts, and that way he was able to diagnose things that other people weren't able to understand problems, to understand situations, to link things together. So Torah knowledge shouldn't narrow the mind. Torah knowledge should explode the mind. And what about narrowness of opinion? Torah knowledge should give one such security and confidence in one's ability to engage in debate that you can deal with other people's opinions. You don't have to close off opinions that are different to yours. You can deal with them, you can expand, you can learn from other opinions, you can discuss them. There's no reason to become dogmatic. So we see a narrowness develop in all three areas, and my argument is there's no reason for it to develop in any of the three areas. And therefore the challenge of tonight is to discuss how by getting involved in so restrictive a religion can you broaden the experience? And what is the Torah's view really? What is the truth? Is it about breadth or is it about narrowness? What is it really about? Does the Torah surreptitiously really want us to be narrow and marginal? Or does the Torah want us to be engaged and universal? And that's an area of quite a lot of confusion. It's true that there are limitations and restrictions, as we've discussed, but what should be the payoff? The payoff should be, for example, that the social interaction that does take place is much more deep and much more meaningful. That's what should happen. That when B'nai Torah, when people who have a real Torah understanding, interact with one another, certainly, and even when they're interacting with others, the level of interaction should be a deeper one, not a more superficial one. And one has to understand that narrowness assumes a commonness of depth. So we're saying if a person used to have a wide perspective and now has a narrower perspective, he has become more narrow. But what happens if in the becoming more narrow, his depth has increased 1,000 times? His narrowness has reduced by 10% and his depth has increased by 100%. Is that narrower? Why should narrowness only be looked at laterally? Narrowness has to be looked at in all directions. And one has to look at that part of the two, and one has to say, yes, maybe when a person becomes religious, he has a narrower social circle, although that will question too, but the social interaction should be a deeper one. If he's losing out on the breadth and not gaining on the depth, that should be an alarm bell. That should be a sign that he's in the wrong religion. This isn't Judaism. Because it's not possible to sacrifice that connection with the infinite should require the sacrifice of breadth without the addition of depth. One of the spin-offs should be deeper wisdom. Now, there might be things that for time and all sorts of other reasons that one's ability to study a wide range of subjects is limited, but the deeper wisdom one gains in the Torah should provide one with much more richness that more than compensates for the lack of breadth. And the other is, of course, the growth, the spiritual growth that occurs through choice. Just as we said, physical fitness develops through choice. Choice is what creates fitness. Choice is often what creates wealth. Choice is often what creates knowledge. How you've chosen to spend this time. How you've chosen to spend this money. How you've chosen. When you've got choices and you choose one over the other, that really is the development of the individual. That really is the development of the soul. And this is quite difficult in a society that celebrates almost as the highest ideal the ability not to have to choose, to have it all. And having it all is a meaningless concept, even if it were possible. The whole purpose of being in this world is to have to make choices, because that's where the growth is. And what we should do, the way we should develop ourselves and our children, is that every choice is an opportunity to look at ourselves and say, what does this choice say about the person I am? Because every choice we make says something about the person I am. And if we would go through looking at every choice on that basis, the mere act of choosing broadens the soul. The existence, if you can understand the paradox here, the existence of unlimited breath creates a narrowness of spiritual development. Because unlimited breath requires no choice. If you can have A and B, then having A and B becomes meaningless. Having A is only meaningful if a choice was made to have A at the expense of B. Then there is spiritual growth. But if you can say to somebody, do you want, you know, chocolate cake or the vanilla cake, and he says both, then it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean he likes chocolate cake, it doesn't mean he likes vanilla, it means he's a glutton. That's all it means. But if he likes both chocolate cake and vanilla cake, and he says, can I have chocolate or vanilla, he says, but I know I can only have one. That's what's good for me. Now, knowing I can only have one, I have to decide which one. That's a value choice. So it's the very restrictiveness of saying I can only have one piece of cake that turns a choice from meaninglessness into value. And so it is with the Torah's choices. The Torah imposes, of course there are restrictions, of course we have to make choices, but what the Torah does is, it makes every action a choice, constantly. There's always a choice taking place. Do I do this or do I do that? Always a value. Do I do this first and then that? Do I do that and then this? Everything is a choice. And so the process of choice is both a projection of who I am and a development of who I am. The breath, unbridled breath, removes choice. The imposition of choice creates narrowness. That's just a fact of life. You cannot get away from that. If you're going to get into the area of values, you're going to be more limited than you are if you're not in the area of values. Once you're in values, there are limitations. That's why they're values. Value means I value this more than that. And all that the Torah does is it adds a spiritual component. That not only do you have to make choices in terms of what's good for you physically, but you now have to make choices also in terms of what's good and bad for your soul. What's good and bad for you religiously. What's good and bad for you spiritually. The Supreme, the last week's Sedra, in fact, talks about idolatry. And the major error in idolatry is she'ein bohem koach ritzoni kamo shechashvu avdeihem, that the idols do not have any kind of will of their own, and they land up praying to beings where ein meshum nimtzo zulosi lakel yisborachu la'odem b'chayev, that there is no creature in the world other than God and living man that has koach ritzoni, that has the ability to say, I want. I'm doing it because I want. I have chosen to. No other creature has choice. No other creature ever makes a value decision. I could do A, I could do B. I'm doing A because I want to. That's the value choice. But let's move further into it and say, that choice is not really an intellectual process. The seat of choice is not doing a balance sheet and then figuring out which is more profitable than which. That's not choice. Because that's still kind of survival. That's still kind of, if I could prove to you, as I said in last week's show, when we looked at the philosophic reason for the things we can't understand, for why bad things happen to good people and so on, and we said that at the end of the day, if every time you did something good you were rewarded, and every time you did something bad you were punished, then your choices would be Pavlovian, but your choices would not be moral. Because you would be conditioned to do good, you would not be left free to choose. There is a requirement that God confuses us with reward and punishment, leaving us free to make our choices. If we did a balance sheet, an intellectual balance sheet, and we came out that clearly we should do A rather than B, That's not even what we're talking about. Choice, when the Supreme says Koach Ratzoni. Koach Ratzoni means the power of will. That's really what it means. And choice is the power of will. I've chosen it because it's what I want. It's my will determines that. I want this. And that leads us into the whole question of the potential conflict between what I want and what is good for me. And what is the Torah saying to us? Now, want it, but since it's not good for you, don't do it. Or is the Torah saying, don't even want it? Here we have two types of wants and two types of desire. It's interesting, I mentioned to you last week on the whole question of thou shalt not covet. How can you instruct people not to covet? You see something beautiful that somebody else has got and you want it. How can you say don't covet? One of the tenth commandment. And we learned the view of the Ibn Ezra that you can determine something is impossible. And if it's impossible, you don't covet it. Something that's right outside the realms of that possibility. The Sefer Achinuch learns it a little bit differently. And he says, the fact that the Torah says thou shalt not covet means we can control our passions. We can create passion and we can direct, at least channel passion. We can decide what we want to be passionate about. That the human being is great enough to be able to develop and evolve his passions. And to allow other passions to almost disintegrate. The Rambam says it's not so simple. The Rambam says there are certain things we should want and not do, and there are certain things we shouldn't want. He says there's a prohibition, thou shalt not murder. Does that mean you should want to murder but not do it, or you shouldn't want to? Yes, you shouldn't want to. There's something wrong with you if you have the desire and the will to murder. It's already a problem. He said that you want to eat something that isn't kosher, that's served most beautifully, that looks most beautiful, that smells most beautiful, and it's just wonderful, and everybody eating it is having a wonderful time. If you don't want to eat it, there's something abnormal about you. The normal thing is to want to say, that's a delicious dish, I wish I could eat it, but I cannot. So, there are areas where we shouldn't have the passion, and there are areas where we should have the passion, but we don't do it. What if we're not doing it? The Mishnah says that the essence of religious achievement is Aseh Ritzon Chok Ritzono, make your will like his will. The Supreme talks about the Koach Ritzoni, the power of will. Says the Mishnah says, develop congruence, where you become passionate about the things that he is passionate, that God is passionate about. Which develops a little bit along the lines of the Chinuch, that we can expand our passions to link into our soul. Just as when you see this most beautiful food presented so beautifully, smells so good, tastes so good, and you want it, that's normal, you want it because it links into certain things inside you that make you want it, so one can become spiritually attuned to want the things that are good for our soul. But it's not, the ultimate is not to be in a situation where you want A, but you've constantly got to be choosing B. Spiritual evolution is to get to the point where increasingly the things you want are the things that are good for you. The things that you want physically are the things that are good for you physically, and the things that you want spiritually are the things that are good for you spiritually. That you develop that as you move along. That's spiritual growth and spiritual evolution. But what happens when religious observance becomes completely will-driven rather than desire-driven, rather than will-driven? That there is no real passion for it, that there's no real desire for it. It's will-driven. I may not. Do this, don't do that. Learn the rules. And one finds over and over again when halacha is being taught, when Jewish law is being taught, particularly when it's an area of religious practice, it's taught as do's and don'ts. Shabbos, you can do this, you can do that, you can do that, you cannot do this, you cannot do that, you cannot do that. That's Shabbos. Now let's go on to the next one. Kosher, you can do this, you can do that, you can eat this, you can eat this, you can't eat that. This is how you prepare this, this is how you prepare that. That's kashrus. Next one. It's rule-driven. What happens when it becomes rule-driven, and is it really necessary? There's a two very important pieces of Torah that we need to acknowledge. The one I've quoted before in this shiur, and that is a Gemara which the Rambam brings as a halakhic decision. Where he says, if a person has the desire to distance himself from all these things which religious practice seems to regard as evil, so he doesn't want any wine, because wine can make you drunk, so I won't drink wine. Sex, I won't even get married. Living in a beautiful home, no, I won't, because that can make you want money and all sorts of things, so I won't live in a beautiful home. Beautiful clothing, no beautiful clothing, that can make you materialistic, so I give up the beautiful clothing. Gamze derech ro, he says the Rambam, this is an evil approach. The osu lelech bo, and a Jew is not permitted to practice it. Why? The proof that he brings is the fact that a Nazir, a Nazirite, who for the most holy of reasons deprives himself of wine for 30 days, has to bring a sin offering at the end of that, according to some views, because he deprived himself of something which the Torah allows. So what's the terrible thing? It will be a little narrower. So he won't have wine for 30 days. Big deal. Yes, big deal. We see from here already that the Torah does not want that. When the Torah says you're allowed to drink wine, that doesn't mean you're allowed to drink wine, but if you don't, it's better. When the Torah says you're allowed to drink wine, it means God is saying, I created wine for your enjoyment. I expect you to enjoy it. I want you to enjoy it. I want to share that enjoyment with you. I want you to bless me and thank me for the experience you have when you drink it. I do not want you to get drunk. I think you're a mature enough and creative enough and responsible enough being to be able to enjoy wine and not get drunk. I don't want you to be a Nazirite. I'm giving you the Nazirite process. But that's not the ideal. The ideal is that you can handle it. And I'm giving you wine. Wine doesn't damage your soul. If it damaged your soul, I would make a trade. Wine is good for your soul in the right proportion. The Rambam learns from that, therefore, that anything which is permitted, we're expected to engage with. Not we may engage, we're expected to engage in it. In the right way, the right time, the right process, and so on. Now this idea goes further. Where Walter, who's an amazing woman, Rav Nachman's wife, and she appears in the Gemara a number of times. And one of the places is in Chulin Daf Kuf Tes, where she says the following. She asks her husband, called the Osalan Rachmana. I figured something out, she says to Rav Nachman. Whatever the Torah has prohibited, Shalalan Kavase. The Torah finds a way to allow us to experience it nevertheless. There's hardly anything that is just completely out. There's a way. Osalan Dam. You're not allowed to eat blood. Shalalan Kavdo. But you're allowed to eat a liver. And even there's no way you can get all the blood out of the liver. Even if you kasher it the right way, at the end of it, there's still blood in the liver. So if you think blood is healthy, or you want to drink it, or eat it, or whatever, there's a way, there's a kosher way to have blood. You can taste the blood in the liver, and you can eat the blood in the liver, and it's perfectly kosher. Nothing wrong with it. Neither, you're not allowed to have relations with a woman during a menstrual period. But what happens if a man likes that kind of experience? Dantor. There are situations where a woman has blood and it's not nido. So there's a way, one can find a way if that's something that turns him on. Chelet behema. There are certain fats in an animal that you're not allowed to eat. Not because of cholesterol, because of the soul. But that's only in cattle. Chelet chayo, but you can find if you shecht a deer, that same fat in the deer you're allowed to have. And it has the same kind of taste. So if it's really important to you to have that experience, there's a way to do it kosher. The Torah didn't ban all chelev, just ban the chelev of a behemoth. You want the chelev of a chayo, and the chelev of a deer, you can have the chelev of a deer. Chazir, what about pork? Mochad the shibuta, the brain of a shibuta fish tastes just like pork. And that's well known. So if you want to have that taste, you can have mock pork. It's not the real thing, but it's fake pork, but it tastes just the same. Girusa, Girusa, the Shemitah Girusa. If you want Girusa, which is also something that's not allowed, a certain type of a bird, Mishna the Kavra. You can have the tongue of the Kavra, and that has the same taste as the bird. You want to go cook it already? You want to find out what the Kavra is? Aishas Ish. What about if you like having relations with somebody else's wife? That's an interesting way out. How does the Torah allow that? It's also quite a delicious feeling. It's a good, it's an interesting experience for a man. What happens if he wants it? Does the Torah just say no? Yeah, there's a way to do that too. I'm not going to tell you. Next year. Any sponsors? The way is a grusha b'chaye bailo. Let a woman divorce her husband, and at the same time, while her husband, ex-husband is still alive, you have a bit of that feeling. It's not as delicious, but a bit of that feeling you have. It's possible. And the Torah doesn't say that you shouldn't, and it's not right. It's absolutely kosher. Husband and wife get divorced, you want to marry the wife, while the husband's still around, the husband can still be in love with her, the husband can still be pursuing her, makes no difference. She's divorced, you can marry her. Finished. That's the halacha. You like that kind of thing, you can get it. Eishesach, what happens if you like to marry your sister-in-laws? Also, some people are turned on by sisters-in-law. You want to do that? Yevamah. There's the process of Yibum. We don't practice it today, but the Torah, there's a way to do it. Can be done. Kusis, you want a non-Jewish girl? Now what do we do? Do you want that one? The women are saying no. Yefastor, there's the parish of Yefastor. It's not recommended, it's not that. But there's a way to do it. You need to be a non-Jewish girl. There's a way to get involved there even before conversion. Can be done. Bainan lemechal bistro bechalba. Okay, Nachman, my husband, I want to eat milk and meat. How do I do it? Omalu Rav Nachman the Tavchi, Rav Nachman turned around to the chef and said, Zvikula kachli, roast her an adder. If you roast the adder, before if you boil the adder, the deal is that you actually have to tear it open so that any milk in the adder is removed from the adder first. But if you roast it, you don't have to do that. And she'll taste milk and meat together and it's kosher. Absolutely kosher. Says Rav Nachman to the adder. So he accepts her thesis. That there is no taste or experience, permissibly, that anything else, the Torah provides a way, the Torah provides a solution. Why? Why should this even be so? And you're right, somebody else, how does she know all these things? That this tastes like that, and this tastes like that. Mysterious, obviously, and God gave the Torah at Sinai, he said, I'm not allowing you pork. However, there is a special taste that this animal has that many people really like. There's a kosher way to access it. Here it is. I'm not allowing you blood. There's a kosher way to access it. You get the same taste, the same nutritional benefits. So God, in giving the Torah, provides with the Torah an entire framework of being able to access the experiences of the world in a kosher way. Is this a God that wants us to be narrow and restrictive? And bear in mind what the Rambam says again. The Rambam says anything which the Torah allows, you should engage in. Unless it's negative. And there's some things the Torah allows very big level under certain circumstances. But a lot of this is not so. A lot of this is perfectly innocent. And the Torah clearly is not recommending withdrawal and restriction and narrowness. Certainly not in our interaction with things. With objects. There's the beautiful story in the Mitzvah, not so much, but sad, tragic story in the Torah about Joseph and his brothers, and they nearly kill him, and then they decide to sell him to the Arabs, to the traders. And these traders, the Torah tells us, is carrying spices and perfumes. And the Gemara says, why does it tell us that? Because normally, the traders in that area are carrying skins and hides, and skins and hides smell terrible. But spices and perfume have a beautiful smell to make the journey more pleasant for the tzaddik. Yosef is going off to Egypt, and this will give him a certain pleasantness. Asks the Tzelzer Rebbe, just imagine Yosef's situation. He's been thrown into a pit with scorpions and snakes, nearly died. He's hauled out of there and sold to these Arab traders as a slave to Egypt on condition he never contacts his family again. Imagine what's going through this 18-year-old's head. Does it make a difference to him whether there's the smell of skin and hides or there's the smell of perfumes and spices? So if it tells us, maybe to you and I it wouldn't make such a difference. We wouldn't notice what the smell was. We would be so full of anguish. But not a tzaddik. A tzaddik enjoys every sensation. A tzaddik enjoys every smell. No matter what he's going through, he's able to access the pleasures that are allowed to him in a way that is sharp and potent and is never obliterated by his circumstance. And so clearly, there's no doubt in my mind that the Torah requires us to use our ingenuity to access as much as we can of the world in a kosher way. We need to ask, if that's the case, why make a trade? Why create a system that requires us to use our ingenuity to access tastes and experiences that could be easily accessed? I want to deal with that in just a few minutes. We don't have to run still for another 15 minutes, if that's okay with you. I want to briefly look at the second area, and that is not our relationship with things, but our relationship with people. That becomes more complex. So with things, what is our conclusion? The Torah wants us to access the richest experience possible within the confines of the way we are allowed to do it. So the particular object we might not be able to have, you cannot eat pork no matter what. But the taste that you have from eating pork, there's a way to do that. So the experience, the outcome of the experience the Torah wants, the process is determined. Certain processes are allowed, certain processes are not allowed. What about people? And here we deal with two schools of thought that I want to present to you, and it's important for us to understand them both. The first we learnt on Shabbos afternoon, where the question, here I'm going to take you briefly into some halakhic reasoning, and in doing so I need to explain to you, as I have once or twice before, terribly important to understand how the Torah works, and this differentiates it from any other legal or philosophic system. When we work out what's right and wrong, we use a cold, clinical, mathematical system. We have certain sources, certain methods of logic that are as rigorous as any science. And that's what we use, and only that. We don't use philosophy at all in working out what's right and what's wrong. Once we've worked out what's right and what's wrong, we develop a philosophic perspective for it. Why is this right? Why is that wrong? But in working out what's right and wrong, we work clinically and coldly, even if it sounds philosophically absurd. We'll go through the mathematical process until we get the outcome, and then we'll take the outcome and we'll measure it in terms of our philosophic understanding, and we'll try and go in a relationship with it. And I'm going to take you through a bit of the halakhic process, the cold clinical process, before we look at the philosophy of it. The issue is, in this last week's Sedra, God says to Moshe, you'll come to the land of Israel, you'll be there for several generations, you'll get sterile, you'll start serving idols, I'll expel you from Israel, you'll go all over the world, you'll come to foreign nations, you'll intermingle with those foreign nations. Watch out that you don't become, not watch out, you will serve idolatry there. And the result of that is you'll intermarry, and the result of all sorts of terrible things, and then you'll seek God and everything will be alright. And everybody says, what do you mean you will serve idolatry? Is God decreeing? Is that inevitable? Is it a prophecy? Is it a decree? What is it? You will serve idolatry. Ba'avadatim sham Elohim. You will serve. I'll give you the exact wording. Ba'avadatim sham Elohim ma'aseh yedei Adam. You will serve there gods made by man. No question. What do you mean you will serve? And one of the answers given in the Gemara is because outside of Israel, living in a non-Jewish society, you cannot help serving idolatry. Even innocently, you don't mean to. For example, here's an example the Gemara gives, in Avodah Zarah, Zion I think it is, that if you're invited to the wedding celebration, of a non-Jew, an idol worshipper, and you accept, even if you eat kosher food, so you're going to a wedding of your most important customer, your entire business depends on him, his son's getting married, he invites you to the wedding, and you say, I can only come if it's not on Shabbos. He says, I've specially made it on Monday, so that you can come. You say, no, there's another problem, kosher food. I've organized. We're going to have kosher food, you're going to have a full-time mashgiach there, somebody supervising the kosher food, your own utensils, and your own waiter. Nobody will come anywhere near your food. It's all organized. So the Gemara, if you accept, then it says, if you've eaten mizidche mesim, you've eaten from an idolatrous celebration. Not only is it not kosher, it's idolatrous. Terrible thing. So it says the Sipurim, and you see, when you're dealing with people, when you're in business, outside of Israel, outside of a Jewish environment, it's inevitable. You're going to be involved in these situations, and the fact is it's idolatrous. Now, the poskim, the halakhic minds of the generations have tried to find solutions. So the Taz says, maybe we can find a solution here. We have a principle that we've been learning in the Gemara Shir on Monday nights before this Shir. We have a principle that you cannot do business with an idol worshiper before or immediately after his day of celebration. Because if he's done well in the deal, he'll go to his idol and he'll thank the idol, and you've been involved. You've made that possible. You've facilitated that. Asks Tosfos, well then, you can't do business with a non-Jew ever. Because if you can't do, in our society, the non-Jews have a celebration once a week. So if you can't do business 2 days before Sunday and you can't do business 3 days after Sunday, then you just can't do business with non-Jews. What's the solution? How do you function? So one thing Tosfos tries to say is that Christians aren't idol worshippers, and therefore we don't have the problem altogether. But there's another thing that Tosfos introduces and grapples with a little bit, and that is a principle of Eva. You're not allowed to do anything which causes racial disharmony. Even if theoretically you should do it, if it causes racial disharmony, you can't do it. So imagine what would happen if we couldn't do business with non-Jews in a country such as this. And we said, sorry, can't do business with you 3 days before Sunday. And the non-Jew says, I'll come and see you on Monday. And you say, well, 2 days after Sunday, I also can't do business with you. He says, right, then we don't do business with Jews. Finish, that's the end of it. And you've got racial problems. We can't do that. It's not allowed to. It's called Eva. And maybe that's why it can't be done. Answers the Taz and he says, it doesn't work. It's a nice try, but it doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is, he says, the reason that you're not allowed to go to the wedding of your customer's son, the very reason given in the Torah is that by that kind of fraternization, by coming close to them, intermarriage is going to be inevitable, ultimately. If you're at the wedding with one another, and you're drinking with one another, and you're partying with one another, and you're eating with one another, and your children are mixing with one another, there's going to be intermarriage. And that's why you can't. So says the Taz, the very purpose of this law is to encourage racial separation. How can you say, let's get around it, because you mustn't do things that cause racial disharmony? This particular law is designed for some degree of racial disharmony. The Torah wants us to be racially separate. The Torah wants the non-Jews not to invite us to their parties, wants us not to accept the invitations. Wants us to be marginal in that area. Socially, we shouldn't be involved. Want to be involved in business, we'll find a way we can do business, we can do this, we can do that. All sorts of areas, professionally, we can do everything okay. But not socially. Because socially breaks down the social barriers go, the intermarriage disappears. Once you've got intermarriage, you've got the breakdown of the value system. Because now you've got two parents with their husband and their wife who really come from different backgrounds, and if the conversion isn't a genuine, real conversion process, what's really there? How do the children work? What does it mean? As we find already in this country, second, third generation, it's gone, it's finished. It isn't there. You can't maintain Jewishness in that kind of environment. So the place to put on the brakes is no social interaction, says the Taz. The Shach disagrees and says the following. The reason for not participating in those parties and those celebrations is not intermarriage. Intermarriage is the outcome. The reason is merging the value systems. The reason is idolatry. But when you start celebrating and there's a religious tone to the celebration, if it's a wedding and there's a religious tone to the celebration, if it's idolatry, that's the problem. And therefore, since the problem is not one of social mixing, it's a religious restriction, not a social restriction, we can use all the techniques that the halakha allows to get around religious restrictions that wouldn't work for social restrictions. Now, if this is a social, is not a social restriction, what the Shach is arguing is there are almost no social restrictions. That's what he's arguing. If even the law of going to a celebration with a non-Jew is not a social restriction, it's a religious problem, then there is virtually no law that requires social separation. And that's really what I want to put to you. But there's two schools of thought. There is the school of thought of the Taz that says, yes, God wants us to be socially separate, because if not, we cannot maintain our identity. There is another school of thought that says, no, there is no social restriction other than marriage. So according to the Shach, how do we retain our separateness? The Taz has got a point. If we're going to party and eat and drink together, how do we retain our separateness? I've pointed out to you previously that the very laws, for example, the law of not using wine that has been touched by a non-Jew. I'm not talking about wine that has been used for idolatrous purposes. It's one law. There is another law. Non-Jew touches your wine, you can't drink it. What's the problem? What does that tell me? Does that tell me I shouldn't be in a place, I shouldn't be drinking with non-Jews? Or does that assume that I am drinking with non-Jews? It assumes that I am drinking with non-Jews, otherwise how would a non-Jew touch my wine? So what's the big deal? Is the reason now because I mustn't get drunk when I'm, or even get happy? Have a few drinks with a non-Jew? If that were the reason, then I wouldn't be allowed to have whiskey with a non-Jew either. Wouldn't I be allowed to have a scotch? The fact is I'm allowed to have a scotch. I'm allowed to have a gin tonic. I'm allowed to have a beer. I can have two scotches. I can have two scotches and a gin and a beer. As long as I don't get drunk, I can do that. But a teaspoonful of wine I cannot have, if it's not kosher wine. Now, is the halacha mad? Or is there something that we're missing? If the purpose is to separate socially, why am I allowed to drink everything except wine? The purpose is to create an internal barrier, not an external barrier. That we need barriers, there's no question. I said last night, every human being finds security inside a barrier. We build houses with walls. We build walls and fences around our gardens. We create barriers, all sorts of barriers. We feel secure when there is a barrier, not just because of theft. Even if you're living in a society where there's no theft whatever, you will still put a wall around your house and you'll still close the door. You might not lock it, but you will close it. We feel secure behind barriers. And the Jewish nation feels secure behind barriers. But there are two kinds of barriers. There's a physical barrier and there's an internal barrier. The Taz says that God wants the Jews to erect physical barriers around themselves. The Shach says there's no need for physical barriers if there's an internal barrier. If you understand, and here comes my answer to the earlier question, why do we create halakhic situations that require genius to get around, but you can get around them, and they're designed to get around? The answer is the fact that you're using your genius to get around them keeps you intellectually conscious all the time that you're Jewish and you're making choices. The fact that when the tray of drinks comes around, you've got to say, I'll have a scotch but not a wine. And the reason you're saying that is not because you don't like wine, but because it's not kosher wine. That's a value choice. That's saying no. And you've got to be saying to yourself, and why am I saying no? Because they are Gentiles and I am Jewish. Do I need to shove that down their throats? No. Do they need to recognize that I'm different? No, they don't need to know why I'm not having the wine. I need to know why I'm not having the wine. That's an internal barrier system. And the Shach school of thought is, the whole school of thought is that it's an internal barrier system. And yes, we will try and find ways out because the Torah wants breadth, it doesn't want narrowness. But it wants you to find that breadth using intellectual genius within the structure of the halakha, so that you're not compromising what the Torah wants of you, nor are you compromising your breadth of experience. That you're merging your Torah knowledge and thinking process with your desire for wider experience, to do it in a way that always takes care of the fact that you have a Yiddish neshama, you have a Jewish soul, and a Jewish soul has to be treated in a different way. And a Jewish soul has to be differentiated, and a Jewish soul has to be separated. But it's the soul that has to be separated, not the body. It's the neshama that has to be separated. And we separate our souls by these processes, not by physical barriers, argues the Shach. Now, in conclusion, generally when the Shach and the Taz have an argument, we go according to the Shach. So purely halakhically and technically, the view, the prevailing view is the Shach's view, not the Taz's view. The wider view, not the narrower view. However, what I want to put to you in conclusion is the following. The reason that there are more a little bit earlier in the Shulchan Aruch says, a Baal Nefesh in different situation but connected says, a Baal Nefesh Yachmir Al Atzmo, a person who really has a precious soul should take the descriptive view under certain circumstances. What I would like us to understand is the validity in the Taz's view as well. But while the Shach's view sounds more comfortable to us, and that's the halakhic way, and that's good and that's fine, one needs to understand that both schools of thought have wisdom to them. The Taz is not a religious fundamentalist. He's also got the wisdom of the same quality as the Shachs. Where is he coming from? And we need to understand that at the end of the day, particularly when you're living in a polluted society, physical barriers create greater purity. And that's just a fact of life. Does it limit us? Yes. Does it make us more narrow? Yes. But it creates greater purity. So if you're looking at purity of the soul in a polluted environment, physical barriers are necessary. I mentioned the Gemara Shiur today. It's interesting how the Western world has become completely comfortable with the immorality of invading me with pollutants. So you can have a factory spewing out smoke 10 miles down the road and I can sue you because you're polluting my air. You can smoke a cigarette on the other side of this room and I can call the police to have you evicted in this state. Not allowed. Why? You're polluting my air. Free choice, but not free choice that damages me. But you know in near me that the smoke gets from you to me and it can damage me. You understand these things. But if you use bad language in my presence in a way that damages my soul, if I call the police, you'll have me arrested. They're limiting your freedom of speech. Because we are not willing to acknowledge that we can pollute each other's souls just as we can pollute each other's body. Just as you can stand in that corner and you can puff out smoke and that can damage my lung, you can puff out verbal garbage that damages my soul. Exactly the same way. But that's allowed. And it's allowed in movies, and it's allowed on stage, and it's allowed on the television, and it's allowed on the internet. It's allowed. Just warn people. Just tell them. You know, it's not suitable for children. Stupidity. Not suitable for children. What does the intelligent child do? First thing he wants to do is to see it, to figure out why it's not suitable for children. That's a big deal. Tell them it's not suitable. It would be better if they didn't say it wasn't suitable for children. It would be better if they advertised those movies as movies for children. No children would go anywhere near the place. If they advertised it as a teenage movie, no teenagers would go near the place. But adults only. And now they've forgotten. Now our children are safe. Fun, our children are safe. Not at all. And the degree of that pollution is something that we are not recognizing. Does breath require that I say to my children, see what you want? Be bold, yes. That's what breath requires. Does moral breath say to them, you may see what you want, I trust you to make your choices? Yes, it does. That would be great. But is it fair in a polluted environment? So the Taz's desire for physical boundaries should not be discarded as fundamentalist and irrelevant, not in our society. In the Taz's time, you could argue that's a bit extreme. The Taz was probably writing for our time. In his time, it didn't matter that much if we mixed that freely with non-Jews. Today, it could be more of a problem. And by non-Jews, the issue is not even Jew and non-Jew anymore. The issue is value systems. It doesn't matter if it's a Jew spewing out the verbal garbage. Doesn't matter if the movie director is Jewish, that doesn't make it kosher. It's got nothing to do anymore with Jewish or non-Jewish. It's got to do with value system, with purity, with refinement, with nobility. That's what it's got to do with. And to say to my children, I don't want you near those people. I don't want you seeing those movies. Is that narrow-minded? Yes, it is. What is one doing? Protecting the soul. Is it narrow-minded to say, I don't want you smoking in the room? Of course it's narrow-minded. Why am I doing it? Protecting my health. That's all. And that's allowed. That's okay to be narrow to protect my health. But to protect my soul is not, because we don't truly believe in souls, our society. So we're operating in a society that doesn't believe in souls. Because if it believed in souls, it wouldn't allow things that are damaging to souls with the same ferment that it doesn't allow things that are damaging to the body. That's the idolatrous situation. To be living in a society whose laws and norms deny the existence of soul is a danger to a Jewish person. And the Taz's view is insulate. And the Shach's view is create internal boundaries that filter, that allow you to engage and yet create the filters. The purity is in the Taz. The breadth and the color is in the Shach. And it's mentioned in Shul and Shabbos that what the Torah tells us in the Sedra is, after I have sent you out into the non-Jewish nations, out into the world, where you will inevitably come into contact with a wide variety of views and values and practices, and that will damage your purity. That it will give you breadth and color, which you lost in Israel. Because then Oshantin, you got stale in Israel, and that caused the problem. Once you get out there, you'll lose the staleness, you'll get the color. But if you cash them, Mishamus Hashem Elokecha, then you will seek godliness, and you will bring the breadth and color of your diverse experiences to a focused and direct into God relationship, then you've got the best of both worlds. And that's truly what we have to strive for. To find the balance between engaging in a way that isn't spiritually destructive and taking that engagement that creates the color and the richness of experience and bringing that to bear in a relationship with God and with our world that recovers the purity. That's the ultimate of the Jewish experience. That's what I want to put to you. And, in summary, does God want us to experience everything good that there is to experience in the world? Yes, He does. Using certain processes which He's allowed, not using other processes which He doesn't allow. Certainly things that are neutral to our souls, things that don't damage our souls, He does want us to experience. Does that mean that we have to go through complex halakhic processes in order to do that? Yes, if you look at the laws of kashrut, they are designed when a person's traveling, there is no assumption in the Shulchan Aruch that they're going to be kosher restaurants wherever you go. The assumption is you're going to have to be living in inns and in hotels and eating in restaurants that are not kosher. And the whole of your day works as to what you do about that. How do you navigate your way so that you can eat in a way that is perfectly kosher and yet you can survive in a way that is that doesn't limit you completely? The Torah allows that process, but in doing so, in fact, when you're sitting in a non-kosher restaurant figuring out what you can and cannot have, you're much more conscious than when you're sitting in a kosher restaurant eating anything on the menu. and that's how the Shulchan Aruch is constructed, to use your discernment at all times. How can I do this? How can I find a way that is in accordance with God's Torah? So that you're always attuned to God's Torah in whatever you're doing as you engage and experience the richness of the world around you. What about social interaction? The issue with social interaction is, what is the problem? According to the Taz, that we put up physical boundaries because the problem is social. According to the Shach, the problem is intellectual, not social. The problem is we're worried about being influenced rather than about marrying. If the problem is intermarriage, if the problem is social, there's no way around. We must insulate ourselves. That's the Taz's view. The Shach's view is the problem is not social, the problem is value systems, the problem is intellectual. So you can create intellectual and moral boundaries that nobody else has to see but you're conscious of and aware of all the time. The one leads to purity, the other leads to richness. Clearly the desire is that within the parameters we find the balance, each according to their own ability to withstand and to manage these pressures, to find a balance between that purity and that breadth. So that we don't become narrow, that maybe we lose our spiritual purity, but that we're able to integrate the breadth that God has offered us in this amazingly colorful world, in a society in which He's placed us, exposing us to so many diverse and different people, in a way that doesn't compromise the essence of who we are and what we are. That gives you some insight into this, the last paradox that we've been dealing with in the series of paradoxes that we have. As you know some of you, and Rabbi Pogo will probably briefly amplify, I will be away on a business engagement for some weeks coming, so the regular Monday night shiur will be suspended. The Chazan at Fifth Avenue Synagogue is an interesting man, Chazan Maravani. He was in South Africa, my father's shul for many years, and he's a celebrity today. And he was telling me the story, he said, he was just talking about the difference between, I was asking, the differences between America and England, and he said this was one of the differences. He was a chazan in a big shul in London. And as he started becoming internationally famous, Yeshua started objecting, saying, you're hardly ever here. So we're not prepared to tolerate this anymore. So he said, fine, goodbye. By my international celebrity is more important to me than the shul. I make a lot more money from it, and it gives me a lot more pleasure, so that's fine with me. And off he went, and he came to Fifth Avenue. And he came to Fifth Avenue and said, but I've got to tell you, I'm happy to be your chazan, but I'll hardly ever be here. They said, that's fantastic. So for us to have a chazan who's a celebrity, for us to have a chazan who's hardly ever here, when you are here, dude, can you imagine how the shul will be packed? So you know, that's the difference between America and England. So I have to say the same to you, that in one way, thank God that the work that I do is recognized, and that there is a need for that. In South Africa, I'll also be addressing a conference of the Southern African Rabbinical Association, where there's a major crisis of leadership and understanding of the meaning of leadership, and I'll be participating in that discussion and debate and giving the keynote address there, as well as the business engagements where we're teaching companies that when you link morality into strategy, the strategy is better. When you do business the way God intended business to be done, the results are immeasurably better than when you try and figure it out yourself. And the fact that there is a demand for that, and that we're doing work that is recognized and valuable is meaningful, and I hope to you too that you think like Americans and not like British people in that sense, and that you'll understand my need to be away frequently from time to time, and that's the only reason for it. But every Monday night I think about the shiur, and I think about each of you.